Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, now celebrating their 125th anniversary. From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. There's no denying that July in Louisiana is brutally hot. Despite the heat, for 12 years now, every July, thousands of visitors from all over the world beat a path to steamy New Orleans. They're coming in search of a cold cocktail and some great education at the annual Tales of the Cocktail. On this week's Louisiana Eats, we'll hear from founder of the Tales Phenomena, Ann Tunerman. Then we'll get a dose of cocktailian history from the king of cocktails, Dale DeGraw. And we'll visit the realm of the Green Fairy with Pernod Absinthe brand ambassador, Anne-Louise Marquis. Break out the ice, the bar's open on this week's Louisiana Eats. When it's time to talk cocktails, there's no festival more spirited than Tales of the Cocktail. In 2002, Ann Tunerman created Tales as a single event consisting of a French Quarter bar hopping tour featuring an in-depth discussion of the history of New Orleans cocktail culture.
What happened at the time was I was really inspired by the book Obituary Cocktail and started thinking that there was nothing that told our history of dining and drinking and all the famous drinks invented here, all the famous spirits invented here. So put together this walking tour that still takes place today and took people behind the scenes at, you know, Antoine's, Arnaud's, Toujac's, you know, Napoleon House, told them about all these famous places. And to celebrate the first anniversary of that tour, put together Tales of the Cocktail, which that first year, my husband likes to say, we had two events, an opening and closing event, with about 50 people to 100 in the Monteleone Carousel Bar.
Whether you want to learn how to craft the best-tasting drinks in the world, pitch an ancient Eastern European spirit to a new market, or learn how to break up a bar fight, you can do it all at Tales of the Cocktail. Anne tells us how the festival's changed, why it's such a destination occasion, and where it's going next.
It's evolved, but yet in some ways I think it stayed the same. My focus has always been to, despite the growth, have it feel the same. Mm-hmm. I want it to have the same feeling. So I want it to be, you know, sophisticated but relaxed and fun. And it's really grown with the input of the industry. My husband says, and this is really our philosophy, it's the industry's event, we just organize it.
Yeah.
So we have a presenters committee that helps us determine all the seminars. We have committees for our awards. We have committees for our cocktail apprentices. So we're constantly getting their feedback and saying, hey, what should we tweak, evolve, change, update? So I think we've evolved together over the years.
Well, from my perspective, it's one of the most incredible learning opportunities that's offered in New Orleans for people who work in or just enjoy the pleasures of the hospitality industry here. So tell us a little bit specifically about some of the people who present during Tales.
The history is really a big focus because education is our number one element of Tales of the Cocktail. We want everybody to be having a good time, but they're there first and foremost to learn. So again, they're the top people in the world. They're the top, you know, historians. They're the top female master blenders of a Scotch company coming over. So they are really the best of the best, and they understand that these are their peers in the room. I mean, you've said in enough seminars, you know, these people ask very detailed questions, very sciencey, very geeky. But the history is so crucial because I think you have to know the classics before you move on to anything else. So you really have to have a good basics of the classic cocktails, and then you become creative from that. You start making interpretations of those classics or adding contemporary ingredients or doing something else. But I think it's really important that you know those. Those topics always seem to be kind of at the forefront of a lot of the seminars.
Well, it's also really an incredible research incubator. How do you nurture that? Because you're doing it.
Well, that's one of the things I think that's important about keeping that feel, because one thing I learned over the years, and this didn't hit me till about 2006, and somebody told me, they said, hey, like, you're making things happen. And it's like, well, how? Just bringing people together. Because what happens is, by having that feel that I'm really particular about, everybody becomes on the same level. So you could be talking to, you know, a brand new bartender, but you want to learn just as much from him as he wants to learn from you. So everybody becomes on the same level. And I think bartenders are so great about sharing information. Even things like the idea of the Museum of the American Cocktail came about from those people meeting that didn't know each other and talking at Tales of the Cocktail. But yes, we've had people go into business together, people get new distributors, people come up with flavors, you know, all kinds of things. Because I think when you just put all those people together, something's bound to happen. And New Orleans also helps with that a lot, because with the French Quarter being relatively confined, it's not like if we were hosting this event in Dallas, nothing is closed. You can't force any like collaboration.
Yeah.
I mean, I tell people if they literally just showed up and sat in the Monteleone bar, they could do business.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you just sit there and don't move, you can make a sale.
So tell me, Anne, over time, how have you seen the profile of your attendees change?
It's been interesting because we curate the event for the professional bartender. So those are the topics. And we don't have anything that is, say, setting up your, you know, home bar 101. So it's not consumer focused, but yet I say we welcome that hardcore cocktail enthusiast that's just like the foodie, the person that studies wine. They're the ones that, you know, they read Dale DeGroff's book. They read Jim Meehan's book. They're really into it. And those two groups make for really good energy, because the Dales are excited that the cocktail enthusiast are so excited to meet him, have his book signed, talk to him, go to his spirited dinner. But we're still mainly an industry event. That's the core of what we do. I think what's been exciting in the last few years is we've seen more people outside of craft cocktail bars come. Mm-hmm. For example, Ruth's Chris has a woman who has just done a phenomenal job as a beverage director there. Last year, she brought 16 bartenders. It's well worth the investment, because they honestly have, like, you know, epiphany moments at Tales of Cocktail. Yes. And then they are so, like, on board with her after that. But I'm really excited, because when I see Carnival Cruise Line sending people, when I see the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami sending people, the great thing is that means we're all going to be able to have a better mint julep.
Yes.
You know, down the road, a better Manhattan, a better Rusty Nail. Everybody doesn't need to be making their own bitters, but they can all be making well-made cocktails. So to me, that's exciting.
You decided to take Tales on the road. And the first stop was Vancouver in 2012. Yes. Why Vancouver?
A lot of it is gut. I mean, I have certain things that I'm looking for in a city, but Vancouver has a really wonderful cocktail culture.
Boy, it does.
Very much a global city. It had people that, you know, were not getting enough recognition there that we thought. Because what happens in these cities is, like, Toronto gets more attention because it's higher volume. But then, like, Vancouver is really where the dining and drinking and the cocktail culture is happening. But on a much bigger scale, it reminded me a lot of New Orleans, and so did actually Buenos Aires. Very passionate people, global cuisine, people from all over the world go there, very friendly. We had people that had been to Tales of Cocktail from Canada, so they were a little bit familiar with what we were about. And Vancouver was wonderful, so we went there for 2 years. And it's such a great city and great people. You know, what's really been a benefit of those events, and we didn't know it at the time, when we say we're going someplace, the best thing about it is it puts a spotlight on that city.
Yes.
Because everybody else says the same question you did. Like, why Vancouver? They're like, why not Seattle? Why not Toronto? Why not Portland? Other people go say, hey, if they're coming here, something must be happening. I mean, we have bartenders there now that were apprentices with us. They've just gotten a lot of attention. One company, they have their own line of bitters sold all over the world called Kale & Nori Bitters. So it afforded them a lot of opportunities and got them a lot of attention as well.
So now let's go. We've been north of the border. Now let's go south of the border. And you went to Buenos Aires. Now, how did that one come about?
That kind of came about the same way. Nobody makes their way through Buenos Aires. If a brand is doing something, they're going to go to London, Paris, New York. I mean, it's the same in the States, New York, yeah. San Francisco, Chicago. It's right. like the rest of the world doesn't exist. So I wanted to go someplace in South America or Latin America. And again, they have a definite joie de vivre, a love of food and dining and drinking, and a really up and coming cocktail scene there. But what was interesting in that city is that I think we recognize that even before the brands, I mean, we're meeting with brands and they're like, why are you coming here? One guy told me after the event who worked for a brand, he said, I didn't think anybody was going to show up. And I mean, I always panicked, would they get up to be there at 10, 10:30? Because these are late night people.
Right.
But they were. And it was amazing. I mean, the event sold out. All the bartenders were listening intently. Nobody got up and left a seminar. We had translators for everything. But it was really phenomenal. And again, it put a spotlight on them, too, because right now people say, well, why not Brazil? But that's more of like flair mixology, where this is more cocktail culture. And Vancouver and Buenos Aires, it's amazing how talented they are because they do not have the resources we do. You know, Buenos Aires, they only have Angostura bitters. You know, I bring them Peixos, the gift, and they're like, you know, happy out their mind. And, you know, we could get that at, you know, Rouse's.
Right.
You know.
This year at Tails, personally, which of this year's events are you the most excited about?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I'm excited about executing all of them. But really, there's so much good stuff. When people call the office, they're like, which seminar should go to? I mean, really. It's kind of like when people call me and somebody asks me this today. If somebody comes to town in New Orleans, what restaurant do you take them to?
Oh.
I mean, yeah. 50? You know, it's like, I can't, it's like, what type of food, what part of town, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
There's so much good stuff. So at least if they call and say, okay, I'm deciding on these like three seminars.
Help, yeah.
You know, then it's like, okay, but you got to help me, you know, narrow down and then find out what they're interested in as well, too.
Job well done, Anne.
Well, thank you.
I'm so happy.
I look forward
you made
to see what
time.
You're attending this year. So.
Oh, I can't wait. So I'll see you in the lounge.
Yes, I'll see you at the bar.
Absolutely. Anne Tunerman, founder of Tales of the Cocktail.
Un météorite m'a percé le cœur. Vous sur la terre, vous avez des docteurs.
If you've enjoyed a well-crafted cocktail at one of the countless cutting-edge bars across America, Dale DeGroff's influence can be found somewhere in your glass. He's joining us by phone to share the unique history of bar life in America's cocktail palaces and neighborhood saloons. Dale, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
I'm happy to be here, Poppy. Always happy to be, even on the phone with New Orleans.
Tell us, this cocktail story, where does the story begin?
Well, you know, if you want to get historical about it, you go back to Pompeii when they excavated that funny-looking little wine bar with the barrels behind it, and they analyzed and found that those barrels contained wine, and you could imagine people standing around that bar on a hot afternoon in Pompeii and shooting the breeze with the bartender. But what we're sort of focusing on is the United States cocktail culture. And now that we've shared it with the rest of the world, it seems people forget that it actually had its beginnings here. I mean, there was communal drinking in Ireland and Scotland and the taverns, and there was communal drinking in the beer halls. But in fact, the kind of drinking and the kind of atmosphere and the kind of places that evolved here in the United States were unique to us because we were sort of a unique people. We were ornery. We wanted things our own way. We wanted our own drinks made the way we wanted them, and we were democratic. We didn't come from a royalist society, and it was totally a different take. And it evolved in an interesting way. One of the biggest influences was a political system in the 19th century called Tammany Hall that was founded by Thomas Jefferson. These guys were the party of the people. And what happened was Tammany Hall saw these huge waves of immigrants that came in the middle of the 19th century in a different way than a lot of other folks saw them, who just saw them as the great unwashed. Tammany Hall saw them as an opportunity. And they went into these German and Irish neighborhoods in the middle of the 19th century. And we, by the way, we had huge immigration. And they backed a lot of these illegal social clubs, and they made them legal, and they gave them money to get started with fixtures and so forth and so on. And the only thing asked in return was that they allow them to have a political meeting once in a while in their bar, and that they voted Tammany. You know, and so it sort of evolved, this patronage thing around the American saloon of, if you wanted to work for the police department or the sanitation department or whatever, you went to your local neighborhood joint and you talk to the bartender who was an important man and could make that happen for you or your nephew, you know.
So what's this thing about cocktail palaces and neighborhood saloons? What's the distinction there?
Well, there are so many different kinds of bars, and I try to make young cocktailians who are out there doing their rhubarb martinis understand that there is a bar that's close to my heart here in New York City called McSorley's Old Ale House, the oldest bar in town from 1854, and that bar serves light and dark ale, and they don't serve anything else, and I'll be going there for the rest of my life, because it's not about whether they have rhubarb martinis or great sidecars. It's about the life that happens in those bars, and the life that happens in McSorley's is rather extraordinary. And that's what bars, whether they be palaces, where... And I refer to the cocktail palace as sort of the bar just prior to Prohibition at its peak, those long mahogany bars with the white jacketed diamond studded bartenders and the cigar counter at one end and the oyster counter at the other. That was a bar at its maximum. But it was, you know, that was the hangout for the robber barons and other, you know, Wild Bill when he got in town with his Wild West show. That's where they hung out, in places like that. But then there was the neighborhood bar, the McSorley's of the day, where folks whose apartments were too damn small to live in lived, and they really did live in these bars. And that, those barflies were their immediate family, and people came to this town because they didn't get along with their families or they were different from other people, and they came here to be different, and they ended up creating their own families, and the places where they did it was in the saloons, the neighborhoods, you know.
Well, Dale, when you are looking at America's cocktail culture, I know that you always have to look two ways. You have to look at America, and then you have to look at New Orleans, because New Orleans has always been distinctly different from the rest of America.
It actually totally has. It wasn't until Prohibition that men and women began to recreate together in drinking establishments. Women had their tea rooms and restaurants, and men had their saloons, and believe me, there wasn't any back and forth. The women did not dare to take that bar entrance when they went to a bar and grill. They took the restaurant entrance, and that's where they went, or they went to a tea room. Tea rooms was a euphemism for a place where women could go and get brandy and sherry and maybe a little tea, too, if they wanted.
Oh.
You know, just a way for sort of upscale women to go out and recreate and have alcoholic beverages. Anyway, New Orleans, that was unique because throughout the 19th century into the 18th century, men and women continually recreated together in drinking establishments because they didn't call them saloons. They called them coffee houses. And that made it okay, not to mention that European genteel sort of atmosphere that seemed never to leave New Orleans as a result of its Spanish and French and influences, and then eventually Cajun influences in its cuisine and in just the style of life down there. It seemed to be easier, it seemed to be more relaxed, and it seemed to be more tolerant of people's differences. And that is unique, I think, to New Orleans, and it's a lovely thing.
Well, Dale DeGroff, now that you've given us this look back, give us a look forward. What's coming next?
Well, I hope more of the same, in the sense that I hope the saloon never loses its soul, because, you know, John McNulty once said that a good saloon should be a retreat from and a miracle drug to alleviate loneliness. And in fact, that's what bars were in a lot of big cities. It was places where lonely people could go and they could make friends and family, you know. And I would hate to see the life of the bar change to the point where it's unrecognizable, where you don't feel that community that you have felt in the neighborhood saloons, and I'm sure that will continue, because no matter how fancy the drinks are, no matter how much talent, no matter how many unique and unusual ingredients, they're all meaningless if it doesn't come with a dose of humanity.
Well, Dale, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. It's always a unique opportunity to get to speak with the king.
Thank you very much, Poppy.
The King of Cocktails, Dale DeGraw.
Where and when was the classic creamy cocktail called the Grasshopper invented? We'll be right back with that bit of cocktailian history. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. When and where was the classic creamy cocktail called the Grasshopper invented? Philibert Guichet, the second owner of Toujac's restaurant, created the original Grasshopper in 1919 when the sweet, pale green concoction won second place in a prestigious New York City cocktail contest. Philibert promptly brought his winning recipe back to the bar at Toujac's, and its fame spread far and wide. You can still enjoy the original Grasshopper, a combination of creme de menthe, creme de coco, and cream, shaken well and elegantly served in a stemmed glass at America's oldest stand-up bar at Toujac's restaurant in New Orleans French Quarter. Tell them Poppy sent you. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Chris McMillan is a 19th century bartender living in a 21st century world. His love and understanding for classic cocktails is like none other, but perhaps Chris is most closely associated with the classic mint julep. Chris, thanks so much for coming to visit us. Well,
thank you for having me.
Chris, would you walk us through the classic preparation of the julep?
Absolutely. You need just a couple of essential items, preferably a metal cup, silver if possible. Well, and if you don't have that, a Collins-style glass that's thin so it'll more efficiently radiate away the heat from the glass. You need some beautiful fresh mint, crushed ice, and a good bourbon. I take my metal glass, put a small quantity of simple syrup in the bottom of the glass, which is an equal mixture of water and granulated sugar mixed and shaken together until dissolved. You don't have to heat it. It'll dissolve in a matter of seconds. That's why they call it simple. We put just a little bit in the bottom of the glass and then take a large handful of mint and squeeze it in your hand so that you just release those oils, and then drop it into the bottom of the glass. Take a muddler and just gently rub the mint against the sides of the glass, touching all of the surfaces. And the small amount of simple syrup we placed in there acts as an adhesive, so it holds the mint all over the interior of the glass, distributing the oil evenly. And then you fill it up with as much crushed ice as you can get into it, and even a couple of inches above the glass, making a tall cone like a snow cone. Because when you hit it with at room temperature alcohol, the volume of the ice is going to subside dramatically and rapidly. So if you want it to be filled, you need to overfill it with ice. And then you just pour the simple syrup after having gotten the bourbon in there. Pour the simple syrup over it, and sweetness is a matter of preference. The beauty of the drink is its simplicity, and it's about the bourbon, the mint, the sugar, and the ice, and nothing else.
What makes a drink a julep?
Julep was a Persian word, and it meant rose water. If we ever go to places like Limona's or Lebanon's Cafe, and we have their Lebanese iced tea, which is a rose water flavored tea, it's kind of the concept. It very early on comes to mean a flavored syrup, and those syrups were used in connection with medicinal compounds. And inherent in the word julep is a tonic effect. And you had different kinds of juleps dependent upon what tonic effect you were seeking. A spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down, if you will. And by the beginning of the 19th century, julep takes on a dual role. You know, one as this medicinal tonic and the other as a recreational beverage. And it maintains this dual meaning. It was the first drink to popularize the use of ice. Historically, what the martini was to the 20th century, the julep was to the 19th century as the quintessential American beverage.
That is so interesting. And I noticed that you don't stir a julep.
The julep, there are very few drinks that have the quality of being multidimensional, that when you start it, it tastes one way. When you finish it, it tastes a different way. Because of the different densities of the ingredients, you have water from the ice, you have alcohol from the bourbon, you have sugar from the syrup. Each one of those things has a different weight. And so as the drink settles and as the drink dilutes, those flavors have different intensities at different levels. And so the deeper you get into it, the mintier it's going to become, the sweeter it's going to become. I tell people when having their julep for the first time, when you first drink it, you're going to say, oh, my God, can I drink this? It's going to be the biggest, stiffest shot of bourbon you ever had. But if you get to about right here, and that's about two-thirds of the way down the drink, it starts to have diluted and softened up a little bit, becomes a little mintier, a little bit sweeter. And by the time you get to the end of it, you're going to wish it'll never end. It's really a lovely thing.
Well, it sounds to me like all of those people who you see stirring madly in their silver cups, trying to get that icy outside, are really doing the drink inside an injustice.
If you want to make the exterior of the cup frost, it needs to be dry. If it's wet, it won't frost. But if it's dry, it will. And so that's really, it's, again, a matter of technique and understanding of the process.
Would you elaborate for me on the different treatments of the mint and what you're doing and why?
Mint is a delicate herb. And your object is not to crush the herb, but to release the oil, the perfume of the mint itself. And that doesn't require extensive manipulation. I use probably five times the mint that most people use. And by using more mint, it requires less manipulation to produce more oil. If you over-extract the mint, all plants, the green is chlorophyll, which is bitter. And if you over-extract the mint, you will add bitter flavors to the drink. You can hide it in a mint julep under the robust, intense flavors of bourbon. But a mojito, on the contrast, same principle, is often ruined by bartenders who think they're demonstrating their skill to you by showing you their muddling technique. And by over-extracting the mint, they're releasing those bitter flavors, and it destroys the drink. And, you know, I mean, its essence is rum, sugar, mint, club soda. Almost the same. In fact, you could even say that a mojito is probably influenced by the mint julep, you know, and an evolution of the Cuban expression of the mint julep within the context of their culture and their indigenous ingredients.
Well, Chris, I want to thank you so much for treating all of the Louisiana Eats audience to the classic mint julep.
Well, that's very sweet of you. It was my pleasure.
Thank you, Chris. Chris McMillan, 19th century bartender, known for his delicious mint julep.
Oh, face a starter. I didn't know just what I was doing. I had to marry all face ruin. A mint julep. Oh, mint julep was the cause of it all.
Wayne Curtis is the author of And a Bottle of Rum, A History of the New World in 10 Cocktails. Wayne is also contributing editor at The Atlantic Magazine with a regular column about cocktails and culture. Lucky for us, Wayne's also a new New Orleanian, having relocated here from Maine. Wayne, welcome back to Louisiana Eats.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me back.
I want to jump right into the fray here. Did Antoine Amadie Peychaud create the cocktail in New Orleans by inventing his famous Peychaud bitters?
He invented the famous Peychaud bitter, or at least his family did. Whether or not he invented the cocktail is a subject of some controversy, and I'm not going to implicate myself in that right now. He definitely brought bitters to New Orleans, and he made them famous. And more importantly, he managed to keep them going, or those that acquired the formula managed to keep it going. You have to remember, bitters in the 19th century were commonplace. They were everywhere. You had all sorts of different choices of bitters back then. Cocktail guides called for things like Abbott's bitters, Boker's bitters, Staunton's bitters. They all disappeared. A lot of them disappeared around the Prohibition time when cocktails fell out of favor. People are familiar with Angostura bitters out of Trinidad, which seem to have persisted. And Peychaud's managed to persist sort of underground for quite a while, and they're still around and still available and essential in a Sazerac cocktail.
What makes the Peychaud's bitters different from the others? What are the difference in bitters?
The difference in bitters, are basically made of there's three elements in every bitters. So there's a bittering agent, there's flavoring, and then there's the solution in which it's made. Traditionally, they were made in very strong rum. Now they tend to be more made in grain alcohol. But Peychaud's is a little bit lighter than the Angostura. Angostura has a little bit deeper flavor. Peychaud's a little bit more floral, a little more fruity, and pretty heavy on the cloves. If you have too much Peychaud's in your Sazerac, your mouth will go numb.
Tell us what's happening with the new bitters.
Suddenly, we're back to the late 19th century. Just in the last 5 years, there's bitters available everywhere now, all different kinds of flavors. Some of the more interesting ones that have come along are celery bitters, which were called for back in the 19th century and disappeared for 100 years. Now, several manufacturers have reproduced celery bitters. Celery bitters goes wonderfully with tequila. It's amazing what that does to bring that out. The Bitter Truth folks out of Germany, which have just in late 2010 have started exporting some of their bitters to the U.S., have come up with Creole bitters, which is very interesting. It's sort of like the Peychaud's. It's got some of those lighter, fruitier notes, but a little more depth to it as well. And they were really trying to recreate some of the traditional bitters you might have found in New Orleans or in some of the Caribbean islands in the 1880s, 1890s.
Wayne, I know that bitters are one of the essential ingredients on a home bar. What do bitters do to a cocktail?
Bitters really add a whole other dimension to it. They add a lot of depth. In fact, a cocktail, by definition, and I'm talking about the 1806 definition, required the use of bitters. Basically, a cocktail is a sling, which is a liquor and sugar with some bitters added to it. People early on, so this is over 200 years ago, discovered what bitters can do to a cocktail. The one thing it doesn't do, it doesn't make the cocktail bitter. If you add bitters, and I think those who make cocktails know you don't dump it in. You just add several drops at a time. You almost don't notice the bitter flavor to it, but it pulls all the other elements together, and it adds the another layer of flavoring to it. You know, something like the Angostura, you just get a little touch of that cardamom flavoring in there, or Reagan's Number 6 orange bitters. You get a layer of both cardamom and orange in that. In cocktails, you've got a fairly limited number of ingredients, maybe between 3 and 6 in the average cocktail, and you want to be able to taste all of them, and you want to be able to taste how they relate to one another, and bitters helps do that. Bitters helps bring things together.
Well, I know that there are a lot of real cocktailians and the serious cocktail craftsmen in the bars who are now making their own bitters. Would you talk to us about that process?
Making bitters is not all that difficult. It's it can be as difficult as you want it to be. Simply, though, you can just take a grain alcohol, say Everclear or a 151 rum even, and what you do is just pick out some spices that you like. And there's some exotic ones. You can get gentian root. You can get quassia if you go online. It's hard to source locally. But you want to get something with a bittering agent. And then add what you'd like. You could do dried orange peel, some cardamom, some coriander, maybe a little caraway or anise in there. Just mix it all together, say a cup or two of the alcohol, and then just shake it every morning. When you get up, shake it, move it around a little bit, and then let it sit for a week or two, and then start tasting it. And when it gets to some point that you like, strain it out and put it in a bottle. You might want to add a little bit more water to it to bring down the alcoholic content. And you might want to add a little bit of sugar to it, too, just to round it out a bit. And then just start adding a dash or two to drinks.
Wayne, thank you so much for coming back to see us again at Louisiana Eats. And I hope you'll come back again soon.
My pleasure. Love to come back.
Wayne Curtis, spirited historian and New Orleans cocktailian. One of the famous drinks created in New Orleans is the Ramos Gin Fizz. That sweet orange-scented drink is light as air and a perfect eye-opener after a wild night or to get a brunch started just right. Henry Ramos made the first gin fizz in 1888 at his popular bar, the Imperial Cabinet Saloon, where it became such a sensation that it said he often had to employ as many as 20 shaker boys to whip up fizzes for thirsty crowds. When Louisiana's kingfish, Huey Long, was in New Orleans, he made the Roosevelt Hotel his home. He preferred his gin fizz from the Sazerac Bar there. In 1935, Huey was in New York when he discovered the hotel he was staying in claimed to be the home of the Ramos Gin Fizz. Huey called the Sazerac Bar and ordered head bartender Sam Guarino to fly up to New York to teach those Yankees how a real gin fizz was made. It's said that a gin fizz must be shaken for 12 minutes before it's ready. But if that sounds like too much work, there's always the blender. Here's the classic recipe. In a cocktail shaker, combine 1.5 ounces of gin with 1 tablespoon of simple syrup, 1/2 ounce fresh lemon and lime juices, an egg white, 1 ounce of heavy cream, and 3 drops of orange flower water. Now, be cautious with that orange flower water. Its intensely scented flavor can overwhelm the delicate drink with just 1 too many drops. Shake together vigorously and then add ice. Shake the fizz again for another few minutes, strain into a glass, and top with just 1 ounce of soda water. Be careful. This seductive drink goes down so easily, you might find 1 is just not enough. I'm Poppy Tooker, and just like Huey Long, my perfect Louisiana brunch begins with a Ramos Gin Fizz. When we come back, we'll visit with the Green Fairy in a cocktail glass. Stay tuned.
He lifts me up to the sky.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. We all know that branding, marketing, and advertising campaigns determine whether a product succeeds or goes belly up. If there's any alcoholic beverage that's lived to tell the harsh reality of this tale, it's absinthe. At the peak of its popularity, the spirit was demonized and subsequently outlawed around the world. Pernod Absinthe's brand ambassador Anne-Louis Marquis is here to discuss the rise, fall, and return of the Green Fairy.
So Pernod Absinthe has an incredible history, starting from the Swiss Alps down into France, across the river and into France. It was popularized by the French army, who took it with them when they went on the wars to the Middle East, and because it's an anti-malarial. So when they came back heroes, everyone was so in love with the army and so sort of transfixed and obsessed with them that they were the celebrities of their time. Everyone wanted to drink what they drank. So in that time, the green hour was developed, the time between about 5 and 7 o'clock on the boulevards in Paris. Everyone would gather in these beautiful cafes, and everyone would drink Pernod Absinthe.
How did it get that bad reputation?
There's a few things that happened around the turn of the century that didn't help to serve absinthe. So there was a big wine blight that happened. So people stopped drinking wine because there wasn't any. So they needed something else to drink, so they started drinking absinthe. And what happened was the wine lobby was moving to push against absinthe. They didn't want people drinking absinthe. They wanted people drinking wine. So they started rumors. There was a doctor who was doing research on lab rats, and uh-huh. He did these studies, and he came to the conclusion that absinthe was deleterious to human health. that it made you hallucinate, that it made you crazy. He was later disproved time and time again that none of that was true. But at the time, everyone was listening to the scientific doctor. Even today, I have people ask me if it's hallucinogenic, if it'll make them crazy. But the absinthe I'm serving today is the same absinthe we were serving 100 years ago.
It was banned in 1912. And tell me a little bit about that.
They passed a law that said they would not allow spirits or products that were deleterious to human health. There was a misunderstanding about thujone, which is the principal ingredient in wormwood. Thujone was definitely villainized. It was definitely said to be, and in large quantities, it is absolutely a neurotoxin. But there's more thujone in three leaves of sage than there is in an entire bottle of Pernod absinthe.
Really?
Yeah. So,
oh my goodness, yeah. The turkey is a dangerous thing then, isn't it?
So what happened was that the lawmakers didn't understand how much thujone was in absinthe, actually.
Uh-huh.
So there was a lot of work. Once absinthe went out, people forgot about it. They forgot what it was. And in this new cocktail renaissance, they wanted to bring it back because it's such a principal ingredient in so many classic cocktails, especially New Orleans cocktails. So they, a lot of people did some really hard work doing the science behind it, convincing the legislators that it was actually always legal to serve absinthe because the thujone levels were never that high. And luckily, in 2007, they were able to bring absinthe back into the U.S., and we've had this new absinthe renaissance along with all the cocktails that have been created.
It seems to me that prior to the ban being lifted, I had found online some other absinthes that were coming from Eastern Europe. So were they doing something over there? What was that about?
The Czech Republic was the first to bring absinthe back, absolutely. They were the first ones to develop a new absinthe. And they're the ones you'll see lighting it on fire,
mm-hmm.
which is something we would never, ever do with Pernod absinthe. It's a perfectly good way to ruin a lovely glass of absinthe, still light it on fire. But I do have to credit the Czech Republic with bringing it back and making it popular again. It's primarily right now used as a rinse, traditionally in like a Sazerac or a Corpse Survivor number 2. But my job is to get people using it as a primary spirit.
Well, the Corpse Reviver mm-hmm. and the Sazerac are very distinctly New Orleans drinks.
Absolutely.
Elsewhere in the world, are there other cocktails that the liquors are specifically used for?
There's not a lot of drinks that are the base spirit is absinthe right now. There's a few very traditional and very New Orleans cocktails. In France, it's not a big cocktail scene. They really drink things like absinthe, sugar, water.
Mm.
America really, I mean, since the 1800s has been championing the cocktail movement. My thing that I'm excited about is the tiki movement.
And the tiki,
tiki cocktails.
Movement.
And there's a lot of cocktails with tiki cocktails with absinthe in them.
Like what?
My favorite tiki cocktail right now is the Reposado Zombie. It's a full ounce of Reposado tequila and a full ounce of Pernod absinthe. It's a tiki drink. There's orgeat, there's lime, there's simple, there's a dozen other delicious ingredients that make a really amazing cocktail.
Would you walk us through the correct way to drink absinthe? It's actually a bit of a ritual, isn't it?
There's an absolute ritual to it. You want to place about an ounce of Pernod absinthe in a glass. And you're going to set a slotted spoon. There's some beautiful spoons, little holes in it. You're going to set that over the top of the glass with a sugar cube. And then you'll drip water from an ice-cold fountain through the sugar cube and into the glass. You want to get about one part absinthe to four parts water. And that's the traditional way to serve it.
Well, I really want to thank you so much for taking the time to have this chat with us on Louisiana Eats.
And thank you.
Here's to the return of the absinthe.
Yes, I'm very excited about it.
Anne Louise Marquis and the original Pernod absinthe. New Orleans may be famous as the birthplace of the American cocktail and the culture that has grown out of it, but there's one mixed drink that you can get almost anywhere in Louisiana that has spawned a very different kind of culture. Food writer Scott Gold gives us his take on the frozen daiquiri and why this sweet, icy beverage means so much to him.
There's a good reason that Tales of the Cocktail, the booze industry's most illustrious meeting of mixology minds, takes place here in New Orleans every summer. The Sazerac, the Ramos Fizz, the Corpse Reviver, and of course the Vieux Carré have all called the Crescent City home for over a century, ever since a pharmacist named Antoine Peychaud decided that combining some of his homemade bitters with sugar and a little brandy was a good idea. Cocktails in New Orleans go hand in hand. You simply can't have one without the other. Before hipsters started sporting retro-chic handlebar mustaches, suspenders, and arm garters, New Orleans was there. We were here before and through Prohibition, all the way through every wacky drinks fad, and we'll survive all the newer, inevitably more silly trends that are bound to follow. No matter what novel or antique fashion takes the cultural fancy, you'll always be able to get a proper old-fashioned in New Orleans. That, I know, is a certainty. But I've been thinking about one unique aspect of our regional cocktail culture recently, one that has nothing to do with hand-sculpted ice spheres fashioned with a bark lever, house-made falernum, or spirits infused with ghost chilies or rare North African herbs. Quite the opposite. I'm talking about something that, to many, has come to define the drinking culture here. Frozen daiquiris. Now, I'm not talking about the daiquiri proper, that is the Hemingway daiquiri, a splendidly simple combination of white rum, fresh lime juice, and sugar. I'm talking about those oh-so-familiar Willy Wonka-esque concoctions arriving in every hue of the visible light spectrum from Dayglow orange to Smurf blue, radioactive chartreuse, and cotton candy pink. The ones with names like 190 Octane, Craw Gator, Hypnotic, Banana Banshee, Category 5 Hurricane, Triple Bypass, and Tropical Itch. Some, especially the more snooty mixological types, might consider these sugary, overproof alcohol slushies a bastardization of their craft. Especially because they're generally served out of swirling electronic tankards with soft-serve ice cream spigots into giant polystyrene go-cups. It flies in the face of their effete, practiced artistry. Pretty much anyone can yank a lever to dispense a hooch squishy into a 64-ounce styrofoam feed trough punctuated by a straw. No apprenticeship needed, no years of studying recipes, no mustache wax. Just a simple pull, and sploosh, out it pours in just seconds, making sure you don't miss your chance at nailing Living on a Prayer on the karaoke stage. It's kind of crazy, and not a little telling, the New Orleanians have a love affair with the frozen daiquiri. And it takes all kinds, too. I know formidable local chefs and bartenders who take nothing but delight in cooling down with an icy rum runner or jungle juice on a sweltering summer day in South Louisiana. There are now even a number of locations where the hot and thirsty can get a frozen daiquiri featuring top-shelf ingredients and juices made from local seasonal fruit like Ponchatoula strawberries and Mississippi blueberries, and even a frozen Pimm's cup. Having grown up here, of course, I have my own personal history with the city's favorite frozen treat. It was, in fact, the first alcoholic beverage I ever both purchased and imbibed, which happened on Bourbon Street during Mardi Gras weekend when I was 16 years old. On the urging of my buddies, I mustered up enough chutzpah to order a strawberry daiquiri at one of the ubiquitous slushy vendors, which the bartender took no compunction in selling me, as he was literally making money hand over fist. Not that I take pride in or advocate underage drinking, but I didn't get tourist drunk and pass out face first in the unspeakably toxic mess that coats Bourbon Street like liquid garbage. It was only the one, and a small one at that, and I was feeling fine and fuzzy, strolling through the French Quarter with my friends and taking in the sights and sounds and smells, making sure to furtively peek inside the open doors of gentlemen's clubs to see if we could catch a glimpse of the girls. It was magical. I held this story to myself for many years until recently, when I decided to share it with my father. "You walked down Bourbon Street with a daiquiri during Mardi Gras when you were 16?" he asked. "Yes," I replied somewhat sheepishly. "Huh," he said. "Well, so did I." Now that is a New Orleans kind of tradition.
That was food writer Scott Gold. His Food Porn Fridays column can be found each week at nolavie.com. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week when we visit Shreveport's Highland Community Gardens with Grace Patterson of the LSU Ag Center.
The whole culture of this community center has changed around food, and the peer pressure is towards the garden and towards trying new things. And it's great to hear the kids now, when new ones come in, the ones who've been involved in the program will say, "Oh no, we don't say that about our food. No, and how are you going to know if you don't try it?"
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com.
Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Linda Green, the Yakaman Ladies Soul Food Catering. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to executive producer Thomas Walsh and sound engineer Joe Schreiner. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.